Chapter 7. Witnesses to a Murder. Joyce.
You must not speak badly of the dead, I know that. But you know those people who feel the world belongs to them? They say you see it more and more these days, but some people were always awful. Not many, of course, but always a few. So, yes, I'm sorry that Ian Ventham is dead, but there's another way to look at it. On any day, lots of people die, and I would prefer it to be Ian Ventham than a kind person. I've seen many people die, and I've cried a lot of tears, but I haven't cried any tears for Ian Ventham. And now, I have to go and help solve his murder.
So, we're all witnesses to a murder, says Elizabeth, putting photographs of Ventham's body onto a table. Which is wonderful, of course. The cause of death was fentanyl, given by injection very shortly before death. I got this information from one of my sources, a man who's able to read the emails of Kent Police.
What's fentanyl? Asks Ron.
It's a drug, says Joyce. They use it in hospitals to help with pain.
If it was given to him just before his death, then we're all suspects in his murder, says Ibrahim.
Joyce claps her hands.
Oh, wonderful!
There were 64 residents at the gate, including ourselves, Ibrahim tells them. And then you have DCI Hudson and PC De Freitas, Bogdan and another digger driver, and Karen Playfair, who was meant to be talking to us about computers. And then, of course, Father Matthew Mackey. That's 70 suspects. How can we bring the list down? Well, it must be someone who was standing close to him in order to give him an injection. Also, many of the residents are not very fast at getting around. Take out the wheelchairs and walking sticks, and you have 30 names, ourselves included.
So, who wanted him dead? Says Ron. And did the same person kill Curran and Ventham?
Funny to think, isn't it, says Joyce, that we know a murderer?
It's great, agrees Ron.
Well, we'd better get started, says Ibrahim.
Back at the police station, Chris Hudson is speaking to the murder team.
We know the injection of fentanyl was given by someone who was there that morning. So we already know our killer, and maybe Tony Curran's killer too.
Donna thinks about the Thursday murder club. They had all been standing around Ian Ventham, but she could not see any of them as his murderer.
Ian Ventham wasn't a popular man, continues Chris. He had a lot of difficult and possibly criminal business deals, and he was married but dating other women. So tell your loved ones they won't be seeing much of you for a while.
Loved ones. Donna realizes she has not thought of Carl for 48 hours. Soon it will be 96 hours, and then a week. Really, why had she left London? What happens when these murders are solved and she is back doing paperwork?
And I still need the information on the phone number that called Curran, finishes Chris.
Which reminds Donna of something that she's been meaning to check. Handsome D.I. Terry Hallett puts up his arm, and Chris realises he could never wear a T-shirt that tight. Chris is sure that one day Terry will have his office. Terry has 4 children and a happy marriage.
Chris wishes he was Terry, but who knew what really happened at home? Maybe there is some sadness in Terry's life that Chris does not know about. It is unlikely, but Chris holds on to this thought.
"I've got something you're going to like," Terry says. "It's a car that took 12 minutes to travel the half mile between the two speed cameras on either side of Curran's house. The time taken means it had to stop for 10 minutes somewhere in between, just enough to murder someone."
"And you've checked the registration number?" asks Chris.
Terry nods and smiles. He puts a piece of paper in front of his boss.
"Well, this is good news," says Chris.
"Are you sure about these timings?"
Terry Hallett nods.
"That's our killer, surely."
Chris has to agree. It's time to have a chat. Chris and Donna sit on plastic chairs with cups of coffee, watching Jason Ritchie flying and jumping across the ice as he practices for Celebrity Ice Dance. When he was a boxer, Jason Ritchie had been beautiful to watch, a strong, brave athlete. But after more falls than they can count, it is clear that he cannot ice dance. When Jason finishes and steps off the ice, Chris walks forward and holds out his hand. It is the first time that Jason has noticed the two officers.
"Have you got 5 minutes, Jason?" asks Chris. "We've come a long way to see you."
Jason nods and the three of them sit down. He starts to untie his ice skates.
"Thought I might see the two of you again," he says. "Have you got another photo for me?"
"What were you doing at Tony Curran's house on the day he was murdered?" asks Chris.
"I don't have to answer that," replies Jason, pulling off the first skate.
"But you agree you were there?" says Donna.
"Our speed cameras caught you. It gave you just enough time to stop at Curran's for 10 minutes, says Chris.
"I've got a question too," says Donna.
"On the day that Tony Curran was murdered, did you call him?"
"I don't remember, I'm afraid," replies Jason, his head still down.
Chris nods.
"Because a mystery number phoned Tony Curran 3 times on the morning of his death, one we could not find through the phone company. But luckily, it was a number that you had written down and given to PC De Freitas."
Jason pulls off the second skate and nods.
"That was silly of me. Well, it sounds like you've got yourselves a mystery there. Now, I'm going to head back."
Jason stands. Donna and Chris do too.
"I wonder if you'd like to come to Fairhaven Police Station and give us your fingerprints and DNA, just so that we can rule you out?" asks Chris.
"I think our time is finished here, don't you?" says Jason, starting to climb the stairs to the changing rooms.
Chris and Donna watch him disappear and then sit back on their plastic chairs and stare over the ice.
"So, what do you think?" asks Chris.
"If he did it, why did he leave a photo with him in it next to the body?" says Donna.
Chris shakes his head.
"Maybe some people are just stupid."
"He doesn't seem stupid," says Donna.
"Agreed," says Chris.